Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Nico Kennedy. Nico is a practicing doula and the director of research at the Institute of Applied Quantum Biology. She also writes a popular Substack under the name Brighter Days, Darker Nights, where she shares invaluable information on circadian rhythms, pregnancy issues, and home birthing. Nico has been at the forefront of a movement investigating the safety of hospital environments for birthing. As evidence accumulates demonstrating the detrimental effects of hospital lighting, EMF, and some standard practices, practitioners like Nico have reduced the need for unnecessary interventions through safe home birthing practices. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share information that goes well beyond the scope of this podcast. I also share a solo podcast expanding on the contents of this conversation if you'd like to get even deeper insights into our discussion here. Becoming a subscriber is the best way to support my work and this podcast. With all that being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. All right, Nico, thank you so much for giving me some of your time. I've been really enjoying the work that you've been doing over the last year or so that I've been aware of you. So I'd love to hear a bit of a background about what got you sort of more interested in, let's say, the more alternative ideas in regard to health that are out there.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Well, I've been studying birth for about 20 years, and so it's definitely something I really got into birth through the alternative birth movement, and health definitely has always been somewhat of an alternative pursuit for me as well. I guess it really started with hearing my own birth story, which was an emergency C-section for nuchal cord and like heart tones. Hearing that story, then later on, the first birth that I saw was my younger brother being born at home. He also was born with a nuchal cord, but the midwife delivered him, did a home resuscitation. And so seeing the difference in how that was managed and then the fallout afterwards really sparked in my mind the idea that like midwives are heroes that can save surgical interventions when they're unnecessary. Not to say that mine was necessarily unnecessary. In some cases, C-section is the right way, of course, but kind of understanding that divide between what is a real medical emergency and what is something that we can, handle ourselves as a family. So health also has a very similar way. Like right now, a lot of people who end up in the healthcare system end up like, if you're bedridden in the hospital, it can be very difficult to heal from certain things that other alternative practitioners can sometimes heal with just a lot less fuss and drama. Again, not to say that one is always bad and the other is always good, but that there is this tension between what is the best approach. So that has always been a driving factor in my own curiosity and where I've landed with light and figuring out that of everything available, there's many, many effective things, but the one that people aren't really talking about enough, in my opinion, partially because the information is so new. I'm often reading papers that are coming out in the current year, right? So when I started, I was reading 2021. Now I'm reading 2022, 2023, 2024. Now we're in the 2025 papers, right? And it could be a really long time before they actually get into practice. So that's where I've kind of made it my mission to pick up the light torch with regard to maternal fetal health and see how can we move the needle? How can we make things better for families?
It's such a fascinating story. And just like you, I had quite a traumatic C-section birth, which is one of the reasons I'm so interested in helping people get this right and making sure that we can minimize the need for emergency C-sections because it's quite traumatic. It can often end very badly for mother or child, and there are real-life consequences that go on from C-sections. And like you said, that's not to say that they're never necessary. Of course, sometimes they are. But I think it just goes to show that this aspect of health is often overlooked, and really it's mostly the people who have had traumatic births or have been involved in some way are interested in figuring out how to remedy that. And there is a big home birth movement going on right now, thanks to people like yourself who are educating mothers, and generally young mothers are the ones that are making all the decisions. And they like to get all of this right. And I want to start by asking, what does a home birth sort of entail In general, I know there are lots of different ways a home birth can go about. So how does that, how would you explain this to someone?
Right. Well, to move back to where I'm at now with bringing forward the information about light. In the hospitals, we are looking at a 24-hour facility that is operating around the clock. And many people who end up going through the hospital system are end up getting a lot of circadian disruption during that process. So it's really a common story that I hear where a woman is, has labor has started, she's at home, it's really picking up the pace. She's like, okay, it's time to go. They pack their bags, they drive to the hospital, they open the doors, get flooded with all that light, all of the testing, all of the like probes checking, all of that stuff. And then labor stalls. And in my mind, I now knowing what I know, melatonin, which is generally considered a nighttime hormone, right, is what actually primes the uterus to be sensitive to oxytocin. And hospitals, even though the research is there, they haven't put it into practice for the most part. So when labor stalls after all of the hustle and bustle and cortisol flooded through those lights, right, like the lights have a hormonal effect. So it floods cortisol, which then antagonizes melatonin, which then reduces the uterine sensitivity to the oxytocin. So their answer is to supplement with Pitocin, synthetic oxytocin. And that is very different. In a home birth scenario, if labor stalls, there are many other things that would happen generally involved with the natural flow of Pitocin, of not Pitocin, but oxytocin. And oxytocin is very different. It actually crosses the blood-brain barrier and is a hormone that causes a lot of emotional components as well. So when the hospital adds Pitocin, it doesn't include that emotional element. So when I'm talking with moms and they're trying to figure out their birth plans and they're healthy and trying to figure out what they should do, I often will say, think about your birth team and imagine giving every person in the room a hug. And if anyone is there who you're not comfortable giving a big warm hug, if there's anyone that you wouldn't give a hug to that doesn't feel good, then that person should not be in your space, because love is the feeling, the emotional timbre. So again, we also have so much more ability to control the light environment in a home birth setting. So these days, there's an increasing movement of women who are actually choosing to birth without any sort of medical attendant, because the obstetrical industry has put regulations on midwives where they're deciding the risk factor that allows if a midwife can be there or not. And it's not actually in the control of midwives who are licensed. So we're seeing a lot more nowadays of unlicensed midwives and women choosing to birth without any practitioner there who's trained in the birth emergencies, which is really interesting. And there was a paper that just came out of Australia where they were interviewing these women. And so in the medical industry, there's like the idea that these women are stupid, risky, all of this. Whereas when you actually interview them, they're extremely knowledgeable and tend to have much more knowledge and information and facts about birth compared with the women who are just going with the regular program. They're self-educating and finding, oh, well, when you enter into this system, which a lot has to do with the lights and everything, because they're so needing to see everything, because every moment is like, oh, we might need to bust out the knife, or we might need to do an injection, or like all of these things. And part of it also has to do with health. So that's where a lot of my education has gone to the preconception and prenatal care, saying we need women to be more healthy so that they can be healthy to have a home birth, so that they can have the natural flow of hormones that allow physiological birth to take place. Because we know that it is, you know, if you ask a woman what kind of birth she would rather have, many women would want one that is the safest for her and her baby.
I think what's wrapped up in all of this is, and you know, I've been speaking about this with friends for quite some time, and every time I bring up the idea of home birth, a lot of women will say, but what if something goes wrong? And I think that's really the big question, and rightly so. But I think what it's underpinned by is a general lack of confidence in the birthing process in general, a lack of trust in their body to get it right, and this desire to have a doctor there in case something goes wrong. It's almost like willing it to happen in a sense. And, you know, how do you approach this? How do you approach this with people when you're helping them to discuss their birth plan? You know, when they have a tendency to feel like something's going to go wrong and they don't trust their body.
Yeah, and this is partially a cultural problem because when birth was taking place in the homes, most people, most women would have seen births and heard stories of births and them going well. They would have that trust and confidence. So, for example, my oldest daughter, she's now 13, and she has been at four of my births. So she's seen me birth four times.
Yeah.
And most of us, like, and, you know, for me, like, I saw a home birth. I saw two births. Like, I saw a birth when I was 6 years old. I saw another birth when I was 12 years old, right? And so I've seen births go well. And then I went and studied, and I became a doula. Like, at first I was on the track, I was like, I'm going to become an OBGYN and I'm going to change birth from the inside. And then once I found out what would be involved and what would be required of me, even just in the training process, I was like, that would be harmful to babies. So I can't do that. It's not morally right for me to do that. And that's my decision. I'm not saying that's the right decision for everyone, but for me, that was the choice that I made. So a doula is a non-medical role, but being in the birth space, being in the postpartum space with families gave me so much insight into all the different ways that it can go. And if there's one thing that is true about every single birth, I would say that it's surprising. No matter how much you know about birth, it will always find a way to surprise you. And right. So for many, in many cases, it's like, how do you deal with surprises? Are you the kind of person who, if, you know, your friend jumps out from behind a tree in the dark and scares you, like, do you scream and pee your pants and run away? Or do you scream and then start laughing, right? There's, like, how do you respond to that surprise? Because that is what birth will bring. It almost always brings some sort of surprise.
You mentioned that there were things that go on in typical training that you would see as some sort of moral dilemma from your perspective. Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things that are sort of standard practice that if you took a step back, you might go, well, actually, that might not be very good for mom and child?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, many of them. For me, it's a new baby is coming in, and we know this from research, too, that their oxytocin receptors, and we've talked a bit about oxytocin so far, oxytocin receptors are programmed in the beginning of life. So when we first discovered oxytocin, the hug hormone, we found out that it's very deranged in people who have mental health problems. So we thought we were home free. We're like, these people have low oxytocin. We just need to give them some oxytocin and they will suddenly fit in with society and have a good time with people and not be so afraid and neurotic and all of this. But it turns out, no matter how much you flood the oxytocin in, if the receptors aren't there to catch it, it doesn't actually move the needle. And those receptors are, you know, programmed in the first years of life. So if you imagine, I encourage anyone to look up this too, Virginia Apgar, who gave us the current standard test that we do when a baby is born to say this baby is healthy. And just go and look her up, Virginia Apgar. There's a paper you'll see talking about, you know, care of the umbilical cord, and there's a picture of her in there. And she's holding a baby by 1 foot upside down, and the baby is screaming. No mother would intentionally hurt her baby, break her baby's skin barrier in any way whatsoever, right? And that is standard practice. Every single baby that is born is immediately put into painful tests for the sake of protocol. And honestly, it begins before birth, where we now have routine ultrasounds that haven't actually been proven effective for helping with things. The fetal monitoring as well, it's kind of like the modern day shaman belt, where it is considered standard of care. And so there's no way to actually design a study saying with this versus without this. It's just, it's standard of care. You can't design a study that doesn't include at least standard of care. So it's, you can do standard of care plus. And so because of this model, the interventions stack and stack and stack and stack and stack. And we never look back to say, like, wait, what's the actual minimum viable level of care in order to have a mom feel supported? So many women in my community who are actually having many, many children, right? There's that first birth where you're like, oh, I need an expert there because I don't know what I'm doing. And then second birth, you're like, oh, that expert really messed things up for me. I'm going to, they actually made me feel more stressed because many of the practitioners are very traumatized by what they have seen. They've seen everything go wrong. And so you can actually look at the data on this, and the higher the caseload of a practitioner, the more likely they are to start stacking interventions because their nervous system is just wired for danger because they've seen a lot of bad things. And then they end up feeding into that because of the whole hormonal resonance of the birth team. So yeah, in my sense, when I think of how we ought to be welcoming babies, it should be, hello, baby. Welcome. I'm so glad to see you. You are amazing. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for coming to Earth and being in my family. You are a blessing. You are a gift. I treasure you. I honor you. I want you to feel as good as possible through this very difficult transition you're going through from womb, everything being supported, everything flowing through the umbilical cord, to suddenly having to breathe air for yourself, through suddenly having to digest food through yourself, right? It's a very shocking transition. So anything we do to introduce pain in that moment, to me, is the exact opposite of what we should be doing.
I couldn't agree more. And you mentioned ultrasounds before. Is there lack of effectiveness in that they cannot sufficiently pick up any sort of abnormality? Is that the idea?
And, nope, and they absolutely can.
They can.
They can.
So, yep. What is the issue with ultrasounds? Is it that they and I have seen this mentioned before, but I've never read into it, that the ultrasound itself can be harmful to the baby.
Again, they. It's so tricky when you're dealing with babies because it's impossible to design a test that would prove harm. That would be unethical. So we don't have data. We have data to say, we have correlative data. We have, and basically it all got pushed through. And like once it's been introduced, right, there's no way to walk it back. And so to me, we don't have a lot of information. We do know about ultrasound in terms of other tissues. We do know like there's different kinds of ultrasound therapies, right? So there's cases where it can be used where it's actually they're using it to cause healing. And then there's other cases where it causes harm, like depending on the dose. And so in terms of the technology, that is a whole big question. We know there are a lot of things that we are finding out about non-native EMFs, which it is one of. And how that affects cellular health. We do see some, you know, slight statistical things in terms of babies, but again, we don't have that control population to say babies that do, that have and haven't been exposed. And then it also is complicated because like what stage of pregnancy. So in like correlative data between non-native EMF exposure in the early first trimester, we do see more levels of like DNA destruction and fetal abnormalities when moms have really high dose, usually from their work environment in the stage where it's often before they even know that they're pregnant. Later on, as the baby forms, there's less, you know, damage because they're larger. But we also, like, we know that nerves and the myelination process where the sheath that is protecting nerves from electromagnetic frequencies and other things doesn't finish until actually the mid-20s. So there's a lot to say there. But what I'm talking about and think about with regard to the ultrasound is in some cases it is also introducing fear, introducing something that kind of stands in between the intuition and what's actually happening. So it can be helpful for families if they really want to know that there isn't a major congenital abnormality that's going to require immediate care and attention. But it also tends to, there's a lot of false diagnosis of certain things. So some of them, it's like, it's really easy to see, like if the, you know, if the belly is like outside of its body rather than inside, right? Like there are some abnormalities that, yes, are really easy to see. And then there's other ones where, you know, I've heard of so many moms who have the false positive on like Down syndrome, for example. And so then they spend a whole weekend wrecked over this, you know, ultrasound diagnosis that they received. And then on Monday morning, they call and say, oops, sorry, we actually misinterpreted your results. Everything's fine. And, you know, like some people are like, I want all of the information possible. And other people are like, well, if certain things happen in that diagnosis, then it limits the kind of care that their insurance will cover. So in some cases, knowing can actually change the course of care in ways that tend to lead to more and more and more interventions. Baby's size, for example, is one of the ones that is often, right, that will give a growth restriction diagnosis, or especially with the amount of amniotic fluid, depending on how baby is positioned, the measurement for the amniotic fluid can be very, very different. And so they'll say, oh, you have no amniotic fluid, we need to induce. And then baby is born and they're like, oh, this is actually a 7-pound baby. And they thought that it was going to be tiny, right? Or, oh, this is going to be a huge baby. This is going to be a 10 pounder if we let it keep going. And then it's born and it's like a 5.5, 6-pound baby, whatever. They're not always accurate, but they are used to, continue the cascade of interventions. So I think that there are less invasive tests that we can do that would put potentially more people in the level of normal, more people having trust in their bodies, which that trust and love, like I said, gives the hormonal cascade necessary for the birth to proceed smoothly, right? To have that smooth birth that is the way that person, like that's that person's first experience outside of the womb, that first moment. From the circadian rhythm perspective, the apparatus that senses light to program the circadian rhythm is active at birth, even though the visual systems aren't.
Yeah.
So when we're thinking about that immediate first light that happens, right, in a home birth, like my most recent birth, gave birth at home in my bed. It was sometime before midnight. We had candles. If I was in a hospital, and I have had a hospital birth, baby born right before midnight, right? It is bright white LED flashlight shined right in that baby's face immediately. Yeah. So in the case of the baby born at home under candlelight, which is the way it would have been, right? Like 300 years ago, that's the only, a baby born at night would only be exposed to that kind of light, right? We didn't have other options. And so that baby is getting a signal like, oh, it's nighttime. Let's do a nighttime thing.
Yeah.
Whereas a baby born under modern LED lights, it's getting that signal like, oh, it's noon, no matter what time of day it is, right? So yeah. Then that immediate first circadian signal that it gets, and then you think about the sleep disruption that happens for mama and baby all the way down. So it's like there's just so many different angles of things that we could think about in order to like make that the most wholesome, welcoming environment where we're honoring the mom and baby.
I think it's so fascinating that the more we speak about interventions, we just see this pattern of interventions beget more interventions. Mm-hmm. And like you said, once they become standard practice, it then becomes unethical to not do that. So it's mm-hmm. impossible then to study more rigorously the things mm-hmm. that have perhaps not been proven adequately in the past. And, I think we see this quite a bit, even with vaccines. They get treated as it's unethical to not give a vaccine. It's unethical to have a control group, basically. And yep. then you're stuck because the precautionary principle is effectively swapped around the other way. And, mm-hmm. There's no shortage of interventions in hospitals. And my understanding, I'm not sure if this is the same worldwide, but they basically have a time frame within which they prefer the birth to happen, and if it doesn't happen by a certain time frame, they like yes. to induce. mm-hmm. My first question is this something that you've experienced before, where the doctors like to get a hurry on, and what happens when you're artificially inducing that birthing process?
Oh yeah, so this is a great question. There's a lot going on there. So when looking at induction, we have a lot of different things to think about. So an induction that is after labor has started naturally. One of the most common reasons would be if the membranes have ruptured, then the mom is considered at risk of infection. So this is something that is really interesting because sometimes the membranes rupture before labor has started. Other times they rupture afterwards. Sometimes they rupture the membranes intentionally to try to speed labor along, which greatly increases the risk of prolapse, which is one of the, you know, worst emergencies that can happen in birth. When it comes to the membranes rupturing prematurely, they find that is associated with oxidative stress. So that, as you know, redox is a huge talking point when we're looking at circadian and quantum biology, because the charge balance inside of all of our membranes is so important for how every aspect of our biology works. And this is where working with moms prenatally is so important, because one of the best ways to reduce oxidative stress that's easily accessible is earthing and grounding. So I would love to see birth suites, for example, to have earthing and grounding and electromagnetically safe environments, right, to help reduce that charge, because we know that labor itself is a process that tends to create oxidative stress. When you think about all of the work that is involved, all of the muscular contractions, that is mitochondria and muscle fibers working intensely. And so, of course, as they're working, it produces ROS, reactive oxygen species, right? That's just the way that happens. When you see stalled labor, which is when after labor would start and induction would happen, women who have a stalled labor tend to have much higher oxidative stress balance compared with women whose labor just flows through. So that whole question of like maternal exhaustion, stalled labor, rupture of members, all of that is happening through a redox type of cascade. So that is where the kind of food that mom has been eating, the kind of emotional stress, her nervous system level, if she's able to move or not, what is the electromagnetic environment she's around, right? Like all of these things come into play. And in the home birth setting, I guess in the hospital too. In the hospital, it's a lot harder to do this, but this was some advice that I had from the couple who are their dear friends. They were having their last baby at the same time as I was having my first baby. And the husband was talking to me about childbirth. And so they had had a midwife attend their first birth, and they had all of the family there. And it was going on and on and on and on and on and on, right? It was one of those labors that was just going and going until finally they kicked everyone out. And then, you know, boom, baby was born, totally smooth, right? It was like the mom could not relax. It's a Ina May, who's a, you know, big voice in the home birth movement in the United States. She calls it the sphincter reflex, thinking about like the way for the portal of birth to open happens through a subconscious process. Yeah. So I have several workshops that I teach that are about this subconscious process, which happens, is partially a circadian switch with glutamate and GABA. It's partially a hormonal switch. And then it's also big time in the nervous system. So in a home birth, labor stalls, we're like, what do we do? And then like my go-to is that advice, because I actually had that happen, not in my first birth. My first birth ended up being an unintended, unassisted birth, because every time they would ask me, should we call the midwife? I would say no. I didn't want her there. And like once I was into that portal, I could not. And they'd be like, can we call the midwife? Can we call the midwife? Can we call the midwife? Like, no, 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 don't call the midwife. Don't call the midwife. Finally, they're like, it's been 12 hours. Like this could go on another 12 hours. And I said, no, I need to push right now. Got on the bed, pushed my baby out. And then my husband at this point is kind of rolling his eyes at me. He's like, now can I call the midwife? I'm like, yeah, sure, you can call the midwife. My second birth, though, I had to rely on that advice that I had heard. I was surrounded. I was like, oh, well, I've had a good birth. My second one, everyone wants to be here. I'm going to invite my mom. I'm going to invite my sister. They ended up bringing their husbands for some reason. There was all these people around. And it went on day one, day two. And I could not get into the portal. So I was just having endless contractions. They were super painful. It was really stressful until finally it dawned on me and someone's like, what can I do? And I'm like, just leave me alone. Leave me alone. I go into my space, I go into my cave, I am able to go through the portal, and then my baby was born. So the way that you would handle a stalled labor, right, to me, the first thing I think is like, oh, this woman doesn't have the level of privacy she needs. However, in a hospital, they're like, oh, this labor is stalled. She doesn't have enough. We need to do Pitocin. Right. And so they force this hormone that is supposed to happen when we feel loved and safe. And instead, they're forcing it to say, this is just right. So you get the mechanical action of it without the social hug that it's supposed to be, without that blanket of safety and privacy. So there's, you know, the whole approach to it. And so that isn't a case where, you know, baby isn't even necessarily, you know, like they're listening for heart rate tones, which again, like the heart rate tone, Dr. Rachel Reed has done some amazing work on that. I don't know, for those listening, her podcast, The Midwife's Cauldron, it stopped now, but the recordings are all up there. She's has an amazing one about listening to heart tones and the research that we have on that, where it is actually like, the one thing that we can say about listening for baby's heart rate is that we definitely see more interventions when that happens. And so the more interventions, and they're saying like, oh, yay, we're rescuing, we're saving these babies. But we don't actually have the control group to say what would happen with these. And in many cases, babies who are in, you know, in distress by their heart tones, then don't actually, they're not actually in distress. And if you measure, listen to their heart rates afterwards, I was recently talking with a midwife and she was saying this, that she knew this baby and like, it was freaking out and having these crazy D cells and, right. Like the heart rate was like going really, really slow and then back up and then really, really slow. And they're like, oh, this is super weird. Like we're going to watch this baby. And the mom was really determined. And she was like, kind of like getting to that edge of like by her metrics, she's supposed to transfer, but she's also been listening to this baby before labor started and knew that it kind of had that pattern. So she's like, well, the mom really doesn't want to transfer yet. We're kind of at that borderline state. Let's see. The baby was born pretty soon afterwards. Was healthy, but then like at the 1 week, 2 week, 3 week checkups, listening to this baby, the baby is still having those D cells after the birth, right? And so I got that story right at the same time as hearing another story of someone who had a breech and they were listening for baby's heart rate, right? Listening, and everything was fine. And then it just suddenly stopped and they couldn't get a read. And then it was like a huge, big emergency and baby ended up like having severe asphyxia during the birth and it was very bad. And so I'm looking at like, listening doesn't necessarily stop it doesn't necessarily save the baby. In some cases you're listening and baby ends up having the asphyxia. And in other cases, you're listening and it's like telling you like, oh, we need to go and give this baby an emergency exit from the womb. When meanwhile, that baby is just fine, was able to be born, right? And so like that, sometimes like knowing more information doesn't necessarily help in every case. And it's really hard to have like these statistical methods with these large cohorts, no control group with, right? It's like the controls will be like, let's have more ultrasound or less ultrasound. Or, you know what I mean? Like, it's just really difficult to get, like, data. And then there's also, like, that nuance of how do you take this data and then account for the norms? For another example, like, women who are very petite often will have extra time in the NICU just because their babies are smaller, even though, like, them and their husband are smaller. Meanwhile, these women and men who are very, very large and they have these babies and they're like, oh, well, your baby has macrosomia. We need to, like, test their blood sugar because we think gestational diabetes. Meanwhile, like, you know, mom's 6 foot and dad's 6'4", and they're put on the same metric as, like, you know, dad's, you know, mom and dad are both, like, around 5 feet. Like, that we don't really have that nuanced take inside of mainstream medicine to move between general statistical, you know, facts, truths, whatever, and the individual cases. So induction is one of those places where it feels like there's no time. And so it feels like emergency. And that's one of the really difficult things about navigating that. And so a lot of women who end up going through that spend weeks and months and sometimes even years processing and trying to figure out what happened, because like everything was going along and then suddenly there was this strange Doppler reading, or suddenly they crossed, you know, 12 hours with, you know, this arbitrary number of like 12 hours. Like now suddenly everyone's telling like risk. And then things are swept along and then suddenly they've had, you know, emergency C-section. And, you know, if that has gone wrong, you know, sometimes there's like bladder damage and all kinds of other things. And it's like just a really intense thing that happens so quickly. So preparing beforehand, being involved with birth, to actually see other women go through it. There's a lot to say, and it's a really cultural thing. Another conversation I was having recently was talking about, we were trying to figure out a word. We're like, okay, there's like the extreme of like the free birth movement saying we need no medical intervention whatsoever. Like if a baby dies, it dies. If a mom has an emergency, like it's on her, like she's the only one who can help herself through. Two, every birth is an emergency waiting to happen. We need to have every, like the resuscitation team, the surgical team, like everyone needs to be on call for every single birth, right? So like between those polarities, there's like medical midwives saying, well, like we're an in-between. We have birth centers being like a little closer to the hospital. And then we have traditional midwives who are like, you know, they're not licensed to the state, but they have done apprenticeship and had that hands-on training. You know, there's like a really big range of all of that. So we're trying to figure out like what is the future of birth and how does it look in a community setting in this era? And there's so much for women who are ready to really think about it and to build, in many cases, it's about building that community setting, building that team, building, you know, like I began this conversation with thinking about the hormonal blueprint is to say that when you see the person who's attending your birth, you want to give them the biggest hug. And when they give you that hug back, you feel that warmth as though it's your mother, like it's that protected case. And so, you know, like in many cases, we have complete strangers in the room, which is also to get to that vaccine question where they're like, you know, what point is there in giving a baby whose mom is negative for Hep B? Why does that baby need a Hep B shot? Like, well, if there's a whole bunch of strangers in the room, maybe if a baby's at home where everyone who's involved is, right, like they all are in that community microbiome, much less risk of strange infections for baby compared with being in like an international hospital, right?
Absolutely. I want to ask about epidural. I think a lot of the concern, particularly young women think about when they consider children is, and rightfully so, the pain the process of having to go through something that is unlike anything else they're probably going to experience in life. Mm-hmm. Can you give me a bit more information about what an epidural is and how it's administered, mm-hmm. and also what the potential effects that could have on the baby and the mother for that matter?
Sure. Yeah, that's another really big one. So epidural, are you familiar with attachment theory?
No, I'm not.
Okay. So attachment theory is an idea that humans have three general ways of feeling socially secure. So there's secure attachment, which is what we're all going for. And part of what I was saying with like, when a baby's first born, you don't hurt it. Looking at research on circumcision, it's like what is the best known effect of circumcision in the literature? Interfering with the mother-baby bond, right? Like it's very sad. There's so many cases, and people see it observationally that, you know, baby's born, they start breastfeeding, everything's good. Baby's circumcised, and now suddenly they're screaming, they're rejecting their mom, they won't breastfeed for like many, many hours afterwards. It's horribly traumatic, right? Like, why would you hurt a baby? Driving down that, when the bond is interfered with, then there's a couple different coping mechanisms. So one of them, and again, this is like, you know, you can read it if you want to, attachment theory. But we have then anxious or avoidant are the two ways that it's talked about. And we see this with women, right? So these women, they grown up, they're either secure, anxious, avoidant, or anxious avoidant is like another subarchetype where it's like going back and forth. But an anxious person is like, I need your help. I need you to save me. They're clinging. They're grabbing. They're like saying, come here, bring in. So these women tend to hire doulas. Secure women also tend to hire doulas. Secure women are like, I know that this is going to be really hard and I want care, not because I need it or have to have it, because it's the right thing to do and that's what I want. An insecure woman is like, I can't do this without help, right? And those a lot of the women who go to hospital. Avoidant women are like, they're not going to reach out for help. If they feel threatened, they're going to withdraw. And these women don't tend to hire doulas or intense hands-on care, right? They're like, they'll go through with like the minimum amount of appointments, minimum amount of things. They're like, I can do this on my own. I can do this on my own. And so then we get into the situation where labor comes on and it's unlike anything else. One of my friends and colleagues in the space was recently sharing about how she quit using pain relief for her period when she was getting ready. She's like, I want to have a natural birth and I think I can't handle period pains without medicine. That doesn't fit. And so that was like part of her like mentally preparing herself for this. Because yeah, some women will tell you that it's not painful. Other ones will tell you that it is extremely painful. And from the circadian rhythm perspective, like there's a lot we can say. And again, I have my workshops to teach about this, because not only do we have like the feeling of safety and social connection, but we also have our experience of pain being mediated through the nervous system and through these circadian pathways and redox regulated pathways. So melatonin, it turns out, which as I said earlier, is what will mediate the strength of contractions. But they're like, whoa, women who have high melatonin have stronger contractions that also feel less painful to them, because melatonin mediates pain in the peripheral nervous system as well as in the central nervous system. So a woman who left to her own devices, as the intensity picks up, they tend to go into the dark, which floods their systems with melatonin. So you'll see this when women, even if it is a very bright room, once they get closer to the actual birth portal, they will start, right? Like you'll see them, they'll be like on the couch or on the bed and they're like covering their head, right? Covering their eyes, right? Giving that feeling of safety. And then baby comes through there. But with the availability of epidural, that is done in a cortisol type of light environment, right? Mm-hmm. And so if the women aren't allowed, like they're not ready to vocalize. And so this is extremely common, especially for women who do have that avoidant attachment style, right? The pain starts coming on. And I've talked with many women who've said, yes, that was my case. The pain starts coming on and the normal response would be to start vocalizing, right? Like that we would be making the noises of birth. There's a wonderful paper I highly recommend everyone reads. It's called Midwifery by Ear, talking about the normal noises of birth. And so when that happens, then women are like, I can't do that. That is calling out. There are people here who I don't know. There's no way I'm going to let them hear me say this. You're not going to hear me mooing like a cow or whatever. So then that's the point that they then ask for the epidural.
Yeah.
The epidural is then, it's a big needle, mm-hmm. big needle into the back. So I've never had one, so I don't know what it's like. But I do know that sometimes there are complications where like one side of the body goes numb, but not the other. And then there are limitations. As soon as that epidural is introduced, then, you know, the legs don't really work. So then you can't have movement. You're kind of like stuck where you are. And that's where having a doula is really helpful, because they can help you move your legs to like go back and forth to help bring baby down, because normally it's a spiralic path. So women left to their own devices in birth are going to be spiraling their baby down, right? You think about that spiralic motion, whereas then the epidural is introduced and they're locked. They no longer have the ability to move and flow. So it, and then it's also a you know, it is drugs. Most epidurals contain fentanyl, is the one that's used a lot nowadays. There are other ones. Many women also, that before they take the epidural, they're like, oh, well, we'll just try oral. So they give them like oral opioids and things. They used to use little hits of laughing gas. Some birth centers still have that. There's a lot of different things. I recently read a trial about using red light therapy, which, as you know, red light stimulates the mitochondria to release melatonin. They found it was just as effective as like a hot shower, you know, warm bath, or other ways that women use. But I think that one of the big challenges with epidural is that there's an outsourcing. Like, that is a moment where it is, the pain brings endorphins that help mediate the pain. You shut down that pain. You go to someone else. You say, you saved me from this. Then you're saved from the pain of labor. But the pains of parenting, like that pattern continues, right? Then breastfeeding is difficult and you need to be saved from the pain of breastfeeding. And then the terrible twos are different and you need to be saved from the challenge of the terrible twos, and you're, you know, outsourcing to daycare. And then like teaching kids how to read is difficult. So then you're like outsourcing to the educational system. And then, right, like all, it just like kind of goes on and on, that there's then a dissociation where this is a threshold that women would pass through the portal. So, yeah, there's the physical challenges of it, but then there's also like the meaning that is made, right? And so when the meaning that is made is that someone else can save you from the pain, and women are so different in the ways that they handle it. And when I'm teaching, I'm like, we can use light to facilitate a trance state that is the body's like way that it has, right? We have neurotransmitters, right? Like serotonin way increases during a daytime labor, serotonin. And when you like look at studies on serotonin, like serotonin, as you know, is like involved in the euphoria. Like that's what people are messing with a lot of recreational drugs. And so a labor is generally, you know, like left to its own devices in nature under natural sunlight. And I have a bunch of pictures of this too, of like outdoor birthing environments that women used to facilitate for themselves. Women used to, you know, gather and maybe make a pilgrimage to an area that has a hot spring. Like there's all these different ways in the past that we had to deal with this threshold of pain that now are just kind of circumvented and kind of necessitated also by the lighting, by not having a team that is trusted, by feeling like you need to do it alone and silently. So it's a big question, not just with regard to like, is epidural safe or is it not, but also like, what does it mean for families?
That's so fascinating that you took that route of explaining. It reminds me of some anthropological studies, I think, where they asked people who had done like tribal scarring or tribal tattoos that are very painful. And they were asked, these people, you know, if you could have done this without the pain, would they have done it? And they said, no, the pain was necessary. It was a necessary part of the ritual. And it makes me think about, you know, giving birth. Is pain, does that make it, does that underscore its importance in a sense that you've been through something so incredibly difficult and challenging and incredible? And that sort of makes it, gives it this particular meaning. And I think, yeah, it's just like you said, what meaning does that ascribe if you, you know, even if it's all subconscious, what does that say to you, particularly if you're going to have multiple children?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've, you know, having been in the birth space, I've seen women who like, they're sobbing. This is so painful. I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I don't even want another baby. Like, why is this happening? Right. They're sobbing. They have their baby, and it's like a switch is flipped. They have their baby lifted up onto their chest, and suddenly they're still sobbing, but it has turned to tears of joy. And they're saying, I've never been so happy in my entire life.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just like on a switch. It's just like from one minute of like from the, to the depths, and the other to the, to the heights. And so dopamine is very involved in that. It'd be a whole other something I get into in my workshop, the whole other issue. Dopamine is controlling the timing of the contractions. And so that's one of the other challenges with today's world, where like dopamine is just all over the place because it is mediated by light and it's supposed to be happening from being outside working in sunlight and that kind of thing. And instead it's being like, you know, forced through electronics and lighting and things. And so that's where birth off, you know, a lot of women have such a horrible experience in childbirth that they're like, I never want to do it again. Whereas women who have these, I tend to call them transcendental, because it's like kind of outside of the normal state of consciousness that we're in. Day to day, you have to be able to go into that transcendental space to, you know, women talk about it as though they're like, you know, fetching their babies from the heavens, or, you know, all kinds of, there's a whole like pathway. And some women don't experience pain with it. It will be like, oh, like I felt pressure, or, you know, there's all kinds of different ways. And that was, you know, one of the other things I was saying is that birth is always surprising. No matter how many births you've attended, no matter how many children you've had, like birth will always find a way to surprise you.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that a lot of women are afraid of, and they want it to be predictable. They want it to be a certain way. And a lot of providers also get into that, where they think there's a linear path through. And so I'm always saying, like, birth is not linear, it's spiralic, and you may end up healing birth trauma that, you know, from your own birth or from a previous birth, or maybe it was like, you know, generations ago, or like, you know, maybe it's part of like the collective thing, but you have insights and things that happen in that space. Sometimes women hear messages, right? Like things will seem very large that are very small. Like there's all kinds of ways that reality gets twisted. And like I said, I don't know how much of that still happens with epidural, since I've never had one. So I can't speak to what that feels like to go through. There's a lot to say about birth. It is so fascinating. And there's a lot that we can do to make it safer and healthier for babies and mamas, and generally just like more welcoming and like celebratory.
Well, that's a great segue, because I wanted to ask, what do you work with expecting mothers, or expecting parents, I guess, mm-hmm. even preconception? What do you like to have them do to make sure that the risk mm-hmm. During birth is minimized as much as possible? I mean, mm-hmm. this comes back to nutrition, circadian health, light exposure, mm-hmm. EMF, all of these mm-hmm. kind of things. What type of things do you encourage people to do?
Mm-hmm. So circadian, like, right. So I'll say like stabilize, then strengthen. So like the first thing is stabilizing the circadian rhythm, having a baseline of actual dark nights. I usually recommend about 10 hours of darkness, because it takes a little while for melatonin to actually start flowing in the night. And so having that dark environment's really, really important. That is absolutely the one baseline that I think many of today's families are missing, not getting that 10 hours of darkness piece. Once that is stabilized, and meal timing too, like a lot of people have erratic eating schedules, especially women who work, it can be hard to get that like anchoring morning meal. A lot of women I work with who are intending to conceive, they do know that nutrition is important. So I do talk with them a lot about that. And so many women I know, they eat really, really healthy in terms of their food choices, but they don't realize the quantity that's required to grow a new baby and be nourished and healthy through that. So I often recommend doing some kind of like a variation. I kind of look at like I'll recommend that they study the Brewer diet for pregnancy and Lily Nichols' work for pregnancy nutrition. Make a cross section of those two paradigms, because Lily's really good at the food choices and the Brewer diet is really good at emphasizing the quantity that's required. I'd also recommend the root cause protocol to study and learn a little bit about that and how iron and magnesium work for the body, because many, you know, and I have a series in my Substack that's all about the folate cycle. But women are always told to supplement with all these different B vitamins, and they don't really know how they work. And so when you start getting them in like these random varieties, it doesn't necessarily optimize for biology. And we know that folate is extremely important for development, methylation, neural tube development, but also baby's brain. Methylation is what drives the DNA changes for the circadian rhythm to even fire. Like, it's so, so key. So I look at folate, I look at all of that kind of thing. So that's like the nutritional piece, time of day. And then after that, it's getting the daylight. So that's like the final chunk where I'm like getting outside in the morning, getting outside across the day on being, you know, regular. And that's where a lot of women will be like, whoa, what if I live in the far north and there's no daylight. And it's still brighter, and the body has pathways for all of that too. Sometimes women also ask me about like, well, I've been doing cold plunges. Like, can I still keep doing that? And right, there's a lot of nuanced things that we can talk about. But generally, that dark night, having that really high quality, high volume food, and then the time outside and grounding if possible. I also recommend women to do a bit of study with electromagnetic hygiene. And like, if they have, like one of the patterns I've seen is women with severe morning sickness may not realize that they actually have a Wi-Fi router or a smart meter right next to their bed. So we have them move like at least 10 feet away from a smart meter and, you know, at least a distance. And so I will, for women who are living in EMF environments, recommend that they get like some kind of electrosmog meter so they can see where the fields are the strongest and just try not to spend time in those spaces, especially in the very initial first trimester. And then for men, yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. That's preconception too. Sorry, I talked all about the women and not the men, but we have ideas for that too. I know we're getting close to the time. Go ahead. Sorry for talking over you.
No, that's okay. if you've got more time, I also have more things that I'd like to ask you about. But I was just going to add on to that I have been, I've read a little bit about morning sickness and that it's possibly due to the fact that women are more sensitive to mitochondrial toxins during pregnancy in order to protect the baby. So any sort of minor mitochondrial toxin that you would normally be able to deal with actually triggers a response. Is that true to your knowledge?
Yeah. Morning sickness is a big deal. So I have a really, really long free guide inside my Substack publication for moms to get through the morning sickness stage, because so we have the morning sickness, and then for most women it wraps up, but for some it doesn't. It continues into second trimester, even third trimester, which can actually be very dangerous. So it's protective, and there's a whole flood of things going on with normal physiological morning sickness, which is related to leptin and related to, of course, mitochondrial health, related to circadian health, related to hydration levels. So, yeah, there's a lot to say there. And many women have cured themselves with, like, the most basic thing is 10 grams of protein every waking hour, including if you wake up in the middle of the night. Because, like I said, most women don't know how to fully nourish themselves. So yeah, I read about it years ago, the bacon cure, and it actually seems to be effective for a lot of women. When they go to bed at night, they actually put a few strips of bacon next to their bed so that when they wake up in the middle of the night and they feel like crap, they can eat that salt, right? And it doesn't have to be bacon, but salt, fat, and protein. The salt, fat, and protein are what give the body the hydration and give the body the building blocks, because the hormones are always made of either fat or protein, right? So to have all of that substrate, they also function as antioxidants, and a lot of people know that. So they know, oh yeah, pregnancy is a time you need protein. It must be to grow the baby. Like, well, it actually, a lot of it is because of what it does for redox, what it does for the hormone cascades. So yeah, protein is really big. Hydration is really big. Of course, mitochondrial health is supported by all of that. And it's really important because that's when the placenta forms. So the first trimester, if the placenta doesn't form properly, which is a huge interplay with the endocannabinoid system, circadian rhythm, melatonin levels, right? All of that. If it doesn't form right, the placenta is what carries the hormones and things for the later part of the pregnancy. So at first, mom's body's creating all of these hormones. Then the placenta starts to create all of these hormones. And like the placenta creates a huge amount of melatonin that actually goes back into mom's body to nourish her as well as protect the baby.
Interesting.
So that is what will prevent growth restriction, preeclampsia, all of that stuff that happens later on. Placental insufficiency, right? That is set in that first trimester when the morning sickness is happening. So that's where, if possible, I really like to work with women for preconception through that phase to make sure that they aren't ending up in a nutritional hole that is really hard to climb out of.
I wanted to ask about trouble feeding. This is mm-hmm. something that I've hear about a lot, and I evolutionarily it doesn't make sense that child would have trouble feeding, or mother would have an issue producing enough milk and so forth. Mm-hmm. What do you think it might be causing the increase? It seems like it's an increasing issue with with troubles feeding.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with that initial. There's a beautiful video you can find on YouTube if you search breast crawl. But newborn baby, and they put it on mom's tummy, and the baby will slowly find its way up to initiate breastfeeding. Moms who have had epidural, moms who have had C-section, right, like those kinds of things can slow that down, the interventions. And being in that hospital environment, the colostrum, I always say, like, if mom is relaxed, in many cases, she will naturally produce a lot of her milk. We used to support women in this. We would prepare special kinds of foods, have them all tucked in bed, keeping them warm, everything for their mitochondrial health, everything to keep cortisol low in that stage. There's a huge fall in melatonin. So right before birth, melatonin levels will be extremely high, way, way, way higher than in someone who's not pregnant in their third trimester. Like I said, that leads into labor and the oxytocin. Well, then a lot of that's coming from the placenta. So once the placenta is delivered, suddenly this huge source of melatonin that the mom has been having is lost, right? And it's supposed to be, but before, a mom would be taken from that birthing space, she would be tucked into her bed at home, right? And many cultures would actually keep the whole house dark for that initial phase. And when it's a very dark, then it allows her to go into a polyphasic sleep pattern. So rather than sleeping 8 hours, she will sleep like her baby does, where she will sleep in 2 hour, you know, 2 hour blocks around the clock. And so if you put a mom in a warm, dark environment, feed her all of these soups and broths and keep her super warm, and unstressed, right? She doesn't have to worry about anything. That is the environment where initiation of breastfeeding would normally be happening. And when you think about what happens now, hospital, bright white lights, not home-cooked food, strangers in and out of the space all the time, a normal day-night lighting schedule, then you can see how the hormonal blueprint for a breastfeeding initiation isn't set. So then it is much... it's just so much more difficult inside of that environment for the hormones to be working together, right? If you think instead about building a bear cave, is one of the ways I describe it, right? You build that bear cave where breastfeeding is the only thing that you're concerned with for the first month of life, then it does usually work. So I've been talking with a lot of lactation consultants because they also agree, like, it's been very medicalized. And, you know, I've heard of women feeling very frustrated that they were like sitting there, like trying to breastfeed, and like the lactation consultant at the hospital, who's a stranger, the way they experience is it, the stranger barged into the room and started grabbing my boob and shoving it around and telling me I was doing it wrong. Like, that is, you know, that's their initiation into it. Compared with letting the baby do it, letting her experiment, figuring it out. So, yeah, the nutritional piece, the light piece, the level of social support, being familiar with it or not. Like, I am in a community out here in Oregon. There's a lot of home birthing moms, right? Every single month I go to a group, and we're sitting there, and we have 20 kids of all ages, you know, five of them are babies, and we're all sitting there like, you know, breastfeeding out in the sun. And so to me, it's like very normal. I see this, it's happening all the time around me. And if I have any questions, I have any number of a dozen moms that I could call for help. Whereas so many women, like, you know, generations ago, they don't do this anymore, but they used to just give a woman a shot and be like, oh, you don't want the trouble of breastfeeding. Shh, give her a shot that would then stop that. So like a whole generation kind of lost the wisdom and we're now having to rebuild it.
Is there, I know this is a very general question, but is there an optimal time of the year to conceive? You know, a lot mm-hmm. of animals, they have specific yeah. times of the year where they breed. And I've often wondered, particularly since moving to Scandinavia, is there mm-hmm. a benefit of conceiving at a particular time of year? Because if you give mm-hmm. birth during winter, there's not really, like, what do you do as far as vitamin D is concerned for the mm-hmm. child? Because yeah. my understanding is that vitamin D is not necessarily put into the milk in adequate quantities. Mm-hmm. It really yeah. does need to come from sunlight. So, yeah, a few, there's probably a few questions rolled into that.
Yeah,
but
it
yes.
is. I love that. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a few, I've written about this a few times. There's a post that it wrote like, you know, is there an ideal time to conceive and put the research together on that? Baby's Solar Callus has some of the research on, that, the vitamin D in babies and milk question. And yeah, my ancestors all came from the far north. So I've always been very interested in that. And I found a really amazing survey done of the Sami people who are, you know, the European ancestors living in the far north of Scandinavia. Pre-industrial, they were having an average of 5 kids per woman, lifespan well into the 70s on average.
Wow.
So this whole idea that like, oh, we've extended lifespan, we've improved fertility, we've reduced childhood mortality. I'm like, well, this kind of says that is true compared with early and when we first industrialized and went into the cities,
yeah.
health, lifespan, everything took a huge tank. And now we're kind of building back up to where we're like coming into an equilibrium with society, you know, bringing us back to where we were before all of this technology. And I think that we're going through that again with regard to lighting, because the lights that we're all using were kind of introduced in the 1990s. We've seen a lot of like, that was kind of the point where health spans kind of started declining again for people. I think it has a lot to do with these lights, and other things. But there are patterns with regard to fertility. Even when people aren't trying to, there's just naturally a rise in fertility and birth rates in the seasons where there's sun, where mom can get vitamin yeah. D in her first trimester.
Yeah.
So the first trimester sunlight is really, really important and seems to have a protective effect against preterm birth. And the farther away from the equator you get, the stronger that effect is. And then there's also that effect may also be stronger, I think, in people who have like equatorial ancestry who have migrated out to those poles, right? Their vitamin D metabolism. So like Norwegian population, they did a study on them and their vitamin D recycling, and they found they were extremely efficient at recycling vitamin D. And basically there wasn't an upper limit. Like they were easily recycling their vitamin D 4 months at a time. So like getting the light in the summer, right? And that is fair skin adapted to cold, right? That thing where, and then there's also higher tolerance for oral vitamin D among some of those northern people. Like they did this one in the Eskimo Inuit communities where they were living off of whale blubber, and they found they actually had genes encoded where like if you brought that whale, you know, someone from the equator up there, they would actually probably have a toxic reaction to that level of vitamin D because they're optimized for solar production of vitamin D, and they don't have a huge need to recycle vitamin D or get it through dietary sources because year-round UVB sunlight. So again, it kind of depends on how in tune with the environment you are. So bolus doses of vitamin D, synthetic vitamin D, where they're like irradiated lichen and lanolin, right? Those yeah. ones, a super high dose of that can actually stop the body's recycling processes and cause it to dump vitamin D and be less receptive to vitamin D So that's where I always recommend kind of like a cautious take on vitamin D supplementation in a northern climate, because the whole situation is kind of like you should be optimizing recycling, and getting it from like natural dietary sources. And then with regard to the vitamin D in breast milk, which is not just vitamin D, it's all of the circadian signals. Like the endocannabinoids should be high in the daytime, low at nighttime, which is probably like a lot of women are starting to use cannabis because I think of all the circadian disruption, the endocannabinoid system is a circadian system. And so with the lack of sunlight and lack of circadian strength and stability, I think that cannabis is a medicine a lot of people are finding harmony with because it's giving a lot of the feelings that we would be getting from. And that's where I love working with people who have like who are working on their circadian health, because I find they just tend to be so like chipper and cheerful and optimistic and motivated and have better like follow through than just like general people. There was actually a study on mitochondrial health, where people who have higher mitochondrial density tend to score higher on the positive traits in the Big Five personality test. So like
Wow.
more agreeable, higher levels of extroversion, lower levels of neuroticism, right? That was like a marker that tracked with the health of their mitochondria. So that's one of the other things in terms of like mood disorders and all of that that's just so nice about this paradigm of health and wellness. And you asked about breast milk and vitamin D. So yes, they say it doesn't have enough, but whenever they're like, it doesn't, if someone's telling me that nature doesn't work, then I'm going to be a little skeptical of that claim. There was a really fascinating study done, several of them actually on this, and they found that they had breast milk stored in Japan from like the 1970s. So they're testing it for vitamin D and they're like, oh, like winter vitamin D levels now and then are about the same, but summer vitamin D levels now are way, way, way lower than they were back in the
Right,
70s, right?
right.
And when a woman goes in the sunlight, her the vitamin D levels in her milk go up way, way, way faster than they do in her bloodstream. So they did a survey of women in Nepal, and they're like, whoa, these moms are vitamin D deficient, but their breastfed babies aren't. How is this happening? Yeah, with the question of like, I think that if you actually write rhythms and get light right and diet and everything like synchronized with your environment, then these problems of like breast milk not having enough vitamin D, childbirth being extremely painful and treacherous, right? Surprising, yes. Treacherous and a healthy mom, no, it shouldn't be usually. Yeah, all these things just kind of like they can all come into harmony. Like I think of like all fertility, all fecundity comes from the environment. So like if you saw like if all the fox moms were like all like miscarrying all the time and like you're finding them all like dead of prolapse in the woods, you wouldn't be like, what's wrong with that fox? You'd be like, what's going on in this ecosystem, right? So that's how I
Absolutely.
think of it with humans too. And I'm like, it's not like this mom is unhealthy. It's like this ecosystem needs support.
That's such a great sentiment to have, and that analogy works perfectly. I want to be cautious of your time, and we've covered a
Thank you.
lot already. How can people keep up to date with what you're doing? Your Substack is fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, my Substack is a great way. Brighter days, darker nights. I am also on Instagram with the same handle. I have a website, nicokennedy.com, that has a couple of workshops. Like if you're not ready to go into a membership, you can get like just like an intro there. I have a circadian and quantum care of mother and baby that just kind of goes through a lot of the things we talked about here, lays the foundation for that. And then from there, do one-on-one work with me. Occasionally, I run group programs. My Substack membership, I do events in there and live coaching too sometimes. So those are all good ways. I'm also working with the Institute of Applied Quantum Biology and Quantum Biology Collective. So you can find me in there. I do mentoring inside of those groups as well for people who maybe aren't as interested in birth necessarily, but just in circadian quantum health as a whole. Yeah. And yeah, just reach out to me. I do check my messages and I'm not like, I try to be available to people because I think this information is so important. It is setting up the future of humanity, right? So the way that we're welcoming babies is really important for us, moms right now, but like 10 years from now, it's still important. 20 years from now, 30, right? It just, the more that we improve the culture around birth, I think the more that we can help people have that secure foundation and go on to do really, really great things and not have so many of the mental health troubles and things that hold people back from fulfilling their true potential.
I'm so pleased that there seems to be a growing awareness around this topic. And I thank you so much for being an important voice in this space. Yes, thank you so much for your time and keep doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me, Cameron. It's been nice.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you want more, I have an additional solo podcast on my Substack expanding further on my conversation here with Nico. I've also left links to her website and Substack below if you'd like to recruit her services or read more of her work. Again, if you'd like to support my work and the podcast, please consider subscribing to my Substack as it is where I share most of my thoughts and insights that go beyond the podcast. Please make sure you follow on Instagram and X so you don't miss a post. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.